Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
This is Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. Our next episode features two guests who are creating new culinary experiences in their respective Midwest communities and beyond. Meet Nikki Thompson-Frazier, who founded Sweet Temptation Bakery in Lansing, Michigan. And get to know Aaron Carlman Weber, the founder, owner, and operator of Chicago's Altogether Now. Nikki, thanks so much for joining Eat Your Heartland Out.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have such a cool story, and what you do is, I think, so needed. So tell me and our listeners about Sweet Encounter Bakery and how you got it started.
Yes. So Sweet Encounter Bakery, we specialize in the best gluten-free eats, treats, and cooking classes for all ages. I started because both of my girls had food allergies, and I wanted to ensure they can have the same amazing treats without compromising taste, texture, and flavor. And I feel like we've nailed that.
Well, and you just nailed that description too. So I feel like you've done this once or twice. How long has Sweet Encounters been around as a business?
So Sweet Encounter started out of my home in 2015. We opened our physical storefront in 2022. So it's been 2 years in our physical storefront.
Mm-hmm. So what was the process like to, you know, find the recipes that work to kind of meet all that criteria that, you know, certainly people want, you know, that may have food intolerances or may, you know, choose to just be gluten-free or whatever the situation may be. That had to be a lot of trial and error to get you and the products where you want them.
Definitely a lot of trial and error to get the products where I wanted them to be. And really what it took was a lot of patience and perseverance. And I think that sometimes people see the end result and don't realize the process. So I always talk to people, anything when you're dreaming. Yes, exactly. Right. When you're working hard on something, it's a process and it takes perseverance. Yep. And it takes that consistency and dedication. And so I would even venture to say thousands of different recipes, ways of doing things, mixing things together. I try it and I'm like, it's not quite the way I want it. I change the temperature. I change the setting on how I did things. I mix up a different way. I would do different ingredients. Sometimes I do the same ingredients, but I change the baking temperature. Or it was just a lot of different things that I did until I figured out what worked. And then once I figured out what worked, I started duplicating it.
Right. Sure. And how hard was that to get to scale? You know, one thing to do it in your kitchen, it's another thing to then, you know, get that to work time and time again.
Yes. Now that was a process. And really it was about making sure that we weighed everything, that I literally, as I did things, I took notes to make sure that I didn't forget. Because a lot of times we do things like it's muscle memory, right? So we're used to doing it and we don't even think about some of the fine nuances or small things that we do. So I tried to make sure every time I was doing it as we were growing that I would video myself or either I would write notes as I went along step by step just so I could capture every little thing and then go back and write it all up so someone else can do it.
That's really smart. I think a lot of us do experiment in the kitchen and then we go back and be like, what did we do? What did I do? How did this work? How did I nail it? If videoing yourself, recording it, you know, making sure, really is a fantastic idea, because you don't have to stop and write, and, you know, make sure you have something to write on, and it's, yes, you know, your kitchen could be a big mess. So that is such a good tip for anybody that's listening that might be out there playing around, you know, doing, you know, something in, just for yourself, or even maybe doing, you know, a cottage baking type of thing. That is such a good tip. So I'm going to note that one to myself as well. Did you ever want to just throw in the towel and be like, oh my gosh, like, you know, this is, after the thousandth time I've tried this, I can't, you know, it's impossible to make something that's gluten-free with the best texture or the best taste.
I have wanted to throw in the towel several times, and not just with the baking, because that's definitely was difficult. And there were times where I was like, oh my goodness, like, why can't I make this taste like grandma's, for example? But also just the business process, because as a mm-hmm. business owner, there's a whole nother aspect to yep. the business outside of the technical aspect, right? So right. understanding your customers, your market, advertising, finances. So there have been times where I have literally wanted to throw in the towel, like, okay, I don't know if I'm cut out for this. I don't know if this is too much for me. And I just say that those are the times when you really have to push through, because I always say that there is, you know, that light comes right when it's darkest most, right? So just like, you know, the dawn comes right after the darkest moment of night. And that's the same thing in life. So it's like, just hold on, because you're almost there. Don't give up.
Yeah. I mean, that good for you for sticking it out. And I mean, what you've done is really incredible. And you're right. I mean, I think that, you know, so many times people get excited and, you know, they say, oh, you know, people get, you know, they compliment their cookies or their cakes or their cupcakes or whatever it might be, right? Mm-hmm. Even soaps, you know, whatever. And they said, well, you know, maybe, you know, I can sell these. And then they go to a farmer's market and, you know, it's sort of like this progression. And, you know, the more that you get into it, so you end up getting a little bit of success. And then all of a sudden there's that turning point. What was that process for you going from, you know, making the cookies, doing, you know, testing those recipes, and then developing the menus and really kind of growing the concept all the way from your kitchen, your home kitchen, to now, you know, having a physical space and doing classes, which I want to talk to you about next too.
Yes, it was definitely a journey going from my home into the physical space. It really was just being consistent in my craft and listening to my customers. What do they want? What do they like most? And not always listening to them with an ear, but listening to what the sales are telling me, like what's selling, what's not selling, and listening to people's nonverbals, because I'll do tests, you know, with samples and let them test things. And sometimes people aren't always open to telling you their true feedback, which is okay. But I got really good at reading people. Like, I could really tell if someone's like, oh, that tastes good, but they really didn't think it tastes good. And people who are like, oh, this is delicious, and they really believed it. So I looked at all of those different things to really be able to figure out what are my best sellers and then focus on those things, because you can't do all the things. And once I moved into the store, I really had to prune my menu. And there were things that I really liked, but I knew they didn't sell as much as other things. So you really, again, have to go back to what is going to sell, what do your customers want, and making sure that you focus on those things, but also focusing on things that have a good return on investment, a good profit margin. So all of those things are so important in business. It's not just, oh, this is a great cookie, but okay, this is a great cookie. How do I find the right products to make it so that it's cost effective? And then what's the great price point? And then how do I get it out to my customers and get them to purchase it? So it was definitely an evolution from my home kitchen to being in that commercial space and teaching other people to make my recipes. That was also a challenge.
I can imagine. And I want to turn to that conversation in a second. But what you just said made me think of another question, which is, how do you actually, you know, identify and source those ingredients? Because you can't just go to a wholesale distributor, you know, or Amazon or whomever to get these ingredients, because, you know, you are dealing with, dietary restrictions like gluten-free. So making sure that, you know, or even vegan or sugar-free, whatever it might be. So, you know, I'm sure that in that process, identifying that sweet spot, no pun intended, of, you know, a cost-effective ingredient and the ingredient that works to meet all of that criteria of taste and texture and the rest of it had to be a real tricky process.
Sourcing has been a thorn in my side because of exactly what you said. Really being able to find products in bulk that are gluten-free or that are allergy-friendly. Some of them just don't exist in bulk. I've called some places mm-hmm. and said, hey, can I purchase this in bulk? They're like, or wholesale. They're like, well, we don't do that because they don't really have a structure in place because there's not a lot. It's growing, but there's not a lot of businesses that are completely gluten-free or completely allergy-friendly and operate at a large scale. So with that being said, the market hasn't caught up with the demand. And so I have found that I've had to kind of try to piecemeal things together sometimes. I'm buying things at retail price, which sucks, but some things I do. And then there have been times where I have been able to go directly to the source. Some of my flowers and things like that, I've been able to get directly from the source and be able to get them at a wholesale rate. But it's literally just calling people and then convincing some companies that, hey, if you're selling it to a retailer like Meijer or something like them in a large amount, I'm buying also in a large amount on a weekly basis, you can sell to me. So really getting people to think differently, because sometimes we get so stuck in what is normal or what we're used to that we don't always think outside the box. So sometimes it's really encouraging people to think outside the box. So I always ask the questions because you never know what the answer will be.
Yeah. Now I'm just curious, you know, you're in Michigan, and you mentioned Meijer's, which I know is also Michigan based. We have them in Ohio too, but have you found any suppliers that are actually in, you know, based in Michigan or based in the Midwest?
Yes. So we get our sugar, Pioneer Sugar from, mm-hmm. Yes. So there's a few places that we do use, which is great. And Pioneer Sugar is vegan because there are some sugars, you may or may not know this, that are not actually vegan the way that they are processed. Vegans will be like, no, because some of the way they're processed with, they use charred animal bones to whiten the sugar. Some processes do that.
I've learned something new. I had no idea.
I learned something new too, to be honest with you, when I was doing the research and making sure that my things were in line with different dietary constraints. So that was an interesting one for me.
Wow. I definitely have learned something new. For all our vegan listeners, I am so curious if our vegan listeners have known about something like that. But I know that it does take a lot of due diligence to really be adherent to vegan. And I know that your menu offers, you know, a number of vegan options or things that can be made vegan. So tell me a little bit about your menu, and then we're going to talk about teaching your recipe. So first, your menu, give us, a taste, literally, you know, wish we could actually have a taste of the kind of things that are on your menu.
So we have everything from peach cobbler cupcakes to peach cobbler pie, actually, to red velvet cupcakes, sweet potato pies. We have German chocolate cake. We have apple pie bars. We just have a variety, of course, cookies, brownies. Our brownies are so chocolatey and fudgy
I'm
and
so
delicious.
So hungry.
I know, right? But then we also have savory. So when you come into our bakery, you can get soup. You can get mac and cheese that's gluten-free.
Oh, wow.
You can get a quiche for breakfast, or you can get a breakfast sandwich.
And I see a vegan chickpea chicken, quote unquote, salad sandwich.
Yes, that's right. Yes. And it's really good. So it's made with chickpeas, garbanzo beans, and it's so good. And it does remind you, I love chicken salad. We have a chicken salad sandwich on our menu too, but we also have the chickpea, and it's actually pretty comparable. I think I like both of them. But we want to have something for everyone. Well, for most people, because we can't cater to everyone. It's just impossible. But we do our best to be as inclusive as we can. People don't always realize the importance of having an inclusive dining experience. And mm-hmm. our menu provides that for people, because food is such an integral part of everything we do.
Absolutely.
And when you are serving people, when they come to the table to enjoy a meal with others, they want to be able to eat similar things as well. Like a vegan's not like, oh yeah, I guess I'll just take some fruit for dessert. No, they want a brownie too. You got a brownie, they want a brownie.
Or right.
Like my daughters who are gluten-free, they have food allergies. They want to be able to eat a brownie too. They want the brownie to taste good and not taste like dust and crumbs and whatever else. You know, they want it to taste good. So we really try to emphasize to people the importance of inclusive dining and making sure that it's safe and that more people can have a seat at the table.
Well, and you know, you go one step further by, again, bringing these skills to the masses or to the public, at least by offering classes, which are not just about, you know, cookies and pies, but a whole range of other things. So how do you decide, you know, what you're going to offer as far as these classes are concerned?
Again, for offering our classes, kind of like with our menu, we talk to our customers and we find out things that they're interested in and things that they like. And things also, too, that are easy to replicate at home, mm-hmm. that are nice, hearty family dinners, that are things that is going to bring a smile to your face and to the friends and family members who come and sit at your table. So we really want to make sure that they can bring that sense of home and goodness into their home after they've had a cooking class with us. So we do Tokyo street food, which is fun because a lot of times Asian foods, if it's traditionally prepared, does not always avoid gluten. So we have some interesting takes on what we do. So for instance, there's a yakisoba noodles, and it's actually soba noodle that you can buy, but we use gluten-free spaghetti noodles. So there's different ways that you can make it and still make it taste delicious, and everyone loves it without compromising, again, that taste, texture, and flavor. So we do pasta making classes, which people love. They sell out. We do ravioli, we do traditional pasta, but they're so much fun. And it just lets people know that you can make these things. It's not as intimidating as you think. And you can make them for your family. And you can really have a yummy time in the kitchen.
I want to sign me up. I mean, I'm going to start. I always, every single time I talk to somebody, I get so excited. I'm like, I'm getting on the road and I'm driving to you guys tomorrow because it just sounds like so much fun. But, you know, and I have one friend of mine and I, we always like a couple times a year we'll go. There's like a cooking school and we always try to pick something that's kind of seasonal to do. But, you know, a lot of times there's, you know, obviously there's a number of different types of cooking classes that happen. And in those circumstances, I would imagine that if you have a peanut allergy or, you know, you're gluten-free, you would have to ask in advance, like, hey, I'm going to come for this cooking class that maybe it is, you know, gluten-free cooking class, but has, you know, have the ingredients been segregated? You know, how is the kitchen maintained to make sure that there's not that cross-contamination? How do you handle that aspect with folks coming in for cooking classes and making sure that, you know, your facility is, you know, free of anything that might be a concern?
So we are very open and welcoming to people, you know, clearly that have different types of dietary constraints or food allergies. And we let people know. So people will email us and say, hey, is this class going to have this in it? Like when our pasta making class, it's very easy for us to do two different sauces. So there's been times where we had people who are like, I can't have dairy. Well, thankfully, our actual pasta recipe that we have does not include dairy at all. And so when we do sauces for that class, we'll do a dairy-free sauce and we'll do a regular sauce. But we always ask too, is it okay for dairy to be present? Because we will have dairy present in the facility, because for some people that's not okay. For other people, it is okay. So we just make sure we ask those clarifying questions, understanding what people's needs are. And we are a completely peanut-free facility. So people mm-hmm. love that because it's very hard to find bakeries that are peanut-free. Trust me, I love peanut butter, but peanut butter does not love my kids, unfortunately.
Yeah. And many others.
And many other people's kids as well, and adults. So I have to be mindful of that. And so we just make sure that when we're sourcing, again, we're sourcing products that don't have those in there. And we're just double checking, triple checking ingredients and making sure, especially if we go with a new source, that we ask those questions to make sure that they know that we are allergy friendly and that we can't have any type of gluten or peanuts in our facility. So,
you know, you've managed to think of, I feel like, absolutely everything when it comes to the food that you make and the recipes that you share in your cooking classes, but you're not necessarily like a classically trained, you know, baker or, you know, have a specific culinary background, right?
I do not have a culinary background. So I worked in corporate communications and I also was an executive for a nonprofit, but food has always been my love language. So My friends jokingly called me Oprah Stewart because I literally watched Oprah, seriously, every day.
I love it.
After school at 4 p.m.
Oh, I know it. You and I must be around the same age. That is a core memory right there.
Yes, absolutely. And so I was the friend in high school and college that would be like, you teach people how to treat you and, you know, don't do this or you should do this. And then also I was the one that cooked and baked all the time. And so, yes, I had a hot plate in my dorm. And so back in the day, at least in our, I went to Indiana University for whatever reason, they did not serve dinners on Sunday. So we were kind of off to our own devices. And I literally would be the one making Sunday dinner for all of my friends in the dorm room. So
love it.
With those memories and things, food has just always been an integral part of the way that I show love. And so when my kids were diagnosed with food allergies, about a year or so into that, as I was experimenting, trying to figure out how to feed them, my husband took a job at Michigan State. So we moved to Michigan from Alabama, although I'm originally from Indiana and he's from Ohio, but we moved back up to the Midwest. But it was at that interesting time in my life where it was like, what do I do with my life? And it's like, my kids have these food allergies. Maybe I can make something of it because I do love food. I do love sharing the love of food with other people. And the fact that I could be able to do this and support my kids in the process was amazing. So it was really kind of that perfect storm that came together. But no, I do not have a traditional culinary background.
Well, it just shows that, you know, if you do enough research and put your mind to it and don't give up, you know, you know, the sky is the limit because you really have taken this on by storm. And I can imagine that your background in corporate communications, and the skills coming, as an executive director of a nonprofit, which always means you got to do more with less, you know, you got to be able to, you know, communicate with community, you know, you're going to have to, you know, with marketing, you have to, you know, identify what, you know, the connects with the public. So I can imagine you're drawing upon all of those different skills, and it sounds like they've all really served you well in this endeavor over the last, you know, almost decade. Can you believe it? Even though you've been in a storefront for just, 2 years, you know, you've been at this since 2015. That is just incredible. I want to just switch gears real quick and ask you, because I am curious for myself about your, so selfishly I'm asking you this, about cupcakes in a jar and what that's all about. I also see they ship.
We have been doing cupcakes in a jar for nearly a decade. So since we started, I used to do pitch competitions and I would bring all the judges cupcakes in a jar because they carried well. I didn't have to worry about the frosting getting messed up, anything like that. And they could also take the item with them if they didn't want to eat it all right there during the competition. So I've been doing this for nearly 10 years in terms of cupcakes in a jar. However, we just decided to kind of monetize or commercialize it just actually in the last 6 months. So specifically, November is when we launched our e-commerce. Yes. So we had them in the store and we've been kind of doing them here and there. But last year, we started thinking strategically about how can we actually grow our e-commerce and really, you know, grow our business, grow our reach, and not just make this a Michigan thing or a Midwest thing, but how can we be, you know, all across the U.S.? And we thought about going into wholesale and doing grocery stores and things like that, but we wanted to have a little bit more control over the quality of our products. And so the cupcakes in a jar was like, hey, we know how to do this. We know how to do this well. They ship well. Let's, you know, research this and really create a system around it. So we purchased boxes. Our boxes arrived in November. We sent them to about 100 friends and family as a tester right before Thanksgiving to get their feedback, to make sure that the packaging was okay, everything arrived okay, just testing our systems. And then lo and behold, the day before Christmas, we get a big boost from Oscar nominee Danielle Brooks, who plays Sophia on The Color Purple, because we were sending them out because we created this Color Purple cupcake in a jar and a Color Purple released on Christmas, as you know. And so we were sending them to everyone related to The Color Purple. And Danielle Brooks tried them, and she did a video on her social media on IG. And it was a story, I should say. And it also went viral. So it got us a good little boost right before Christmas. So then we got a boost from Tabitha Brown, and she is a vegan social media influencer, author, actress, all of that. And she tried our vegan purple velvet cupcakes in a jar, and we went viral. So they're such a cool treat. They make a great gift for friends and family or for business clients and things like that. We ship them anywhere. They come in these really cute boxes. You open it up, it tells the story of how Sweet Encounter got started. And it's just brings joy to people. Seriously, people are so excited to get their purple box, and we get all these reviews and videos of people unboxing and how excited they are, how excited their friend was to get the box.
Oh, I love it.
And so it's like, you get this little box of treats and you're so excited and you can't wait to open it, and then it's good. So that makes it all the more better.
Absolutely. And do you ship nationwide?
We ship nationwide, and we have been shipping like hundreds a week since the big Tabitha boom. And we're excited. We're just waiting for, you know, more great endorsements to come along, and, you know, for more people to realize, you know, what we do, because although we are allergy friendly, Danielle Brooks has no food allergies, and she said our red velvet cupcakes in a jar were bussin'. She sang that. I can't sing, so sorry about that for everybody who's like, oh God, the voice. But she sang it. So that's how good it was. Like, if someone sings something, you know it's good. And so it's just a testament that at least actually more than 50% of our customer base right now are people who do not have food allergies. They love our products. They love our mission. They love what we do, and they just support us. And so that's warming to us, because that knows we're doing something right.
Absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely right that, you know, and it shows that all of your hard work has paid off, because people that don't quote unquote have to, you know, eat things that are allergy friendly are choosing to do so because of the taste and again, to support the mission. I mean, I'm looking at the stuff online, and, you know, those cupcakes in a jar are calling to me for sure. And I don't have any of those dietary restrictions. So I would definitely want to try them for at some point, now that I know that they can come to me in Ohio and I don't necessarily have to hop in the car and go to Lansing, Michigan. But is there anything else that you want our audience to know about your mission and your plans for Sweet Encounters?
Well, just to say that we want to continue to grow and grow our e-commerce. So we just invite you to have a Sweet Encounter. When people come into our store, we always say, hi, how can we sweeten your day? And when they leave, we say, thank you for letting us sweeten your day, because we realize that we have the privilege of serving them, that they could go anywhere in the world, right? Or anywhere in the city or the state and get the items that they want, but they chose to come to Sweet Encounters. So we want to let them know that we appreciate them for letting us sweeten their day. And so I think that's the message I want people to go away with when they think about our brand and think about who we are, is that we're all about sweetening people's day and thanking them for allowing us to do so. And more importantly, that anybody now can enjoy a Sweet Encounter because we ship nationwide.
I love it. And if somebody wants to find you to order those cupcakes in a jar, where can they find you?
Yes. So our website is sweetencounterbakery.com. It's really easy, and you'll see the button that says cupcakes in a jar, and you can go right on and order.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Nikki. This has been so fun, so inspiring, and it's definitely making me hungry. So we really appreciate you sharing your story with me and with our audience.
Yes. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This is Eat Your Heartland Out with me, Capri Cafaro. After the break, I'll welcome Aaron Carlman Weber, who is the founder, owner, and operator of All Together Now in Chicago's Ukrainian Village.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Erin, thanks for joining the show and telling us all about your work as the founder, owner, and operator, all of the hats at All Together Now.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
I was just so impressed by learning so much about the operation and everything that you do at All Together Now there in Chicago. What brought you to the place where you ended up starting this business?
Oh, that's a great question. So there were a multitude of factors, both personal and professional, that converged to make All Together Now a reality. I grew up in a family where, you know, all of our social occasions, all of our gatherings, everything important was punctuated by a meal. Lots of conversation around what we were going to eat next, who's getting recipes from where. So that being sort of the water that I was swimming in as I grew up, I think I was sort of naturally drawn to the food industry as a place to hang out professionally. I got to start the way that a lot of people do, just sort of waiting tables. I was a dishwasher in a kitchen, wore all sorts of hats there. And then little by little, sort of, you know, after treating those as side jobs or a way to get somewhere else, it dawned on me that this space was where people were having the most fun. And it seemed like the kind of place I wanted to make a home out of more mm-hmm. Long-term. So worked for a number of different specialty food operations in various corners. So I worked for in a really great cheese shop in Boston called Formaggio Kitchen. Mm-hmm. I worked for a bean to bar chocolate company when I lived in Brooklyn. And then after moving back to my home state of Illinois and settling in Chicago, worked for Stephanie Izard. So she's the girl and the goat gal. And all these different experiences working with small business owners, seeing people who had sort of, you know, inflated a dream of theirs into a real floating thing, was really inspiring for me. So.
I can certainly tell. And, you know, how did some of these experiences, like, for example, working with a bean to bar chocolate company, or even, you know, the cheese shop in Boston, how did those experiences inform the design and the efforts behind the kind of place that you ended up starting in All Together Now?
I think the thing that came up for me over and over again, and the thing that was really compelling, was the fact that the food is delicious, right? But it's also so fun when it's got a story, when you can connect either for real in real life, in the case of, you know, like a local cheesemaker, or just with a story that's shared online that sort of humanizes the process of what we eat and drink. Those stories and that narrative, I think, are a really fun thing to pay attention to. And it guides a lot of the way that we do our sourcing and think about how to structure the products that we bring in, on the retail side of things for All Together Now, and the way that our chef sources the ingredients we use in our kitchen.
So you've just rattled off a few things that All Together Now does. It sounds like it's a retail space. It's also a restaurant. What is the scope of All Together Now?
Depends on what day you ask me. Some days it's just right. Other days it's too big. I like to joke that we try and run in as many directions as possible. But the short answer is that we are a restaurant, we're a wine shop, and we are a cheese counter. So we're all under one roof. We also do catering, special events, and some mail order as well.
How do you keep all that straight? I mean, because those are a lot of different functions with a, you know, they're complementary, certainly, but they also take different competencies, different, skill sets and sourcing and all kinds of things. So how do you keep all of that going, spinning all those plates?
So for me, all of the concepts, even all of the efforts that we make, even though operationally they're very different, they're all, I think, centered around the idea of gathering people around food and drink and being part of those interactions, right? So sometimes it's in our restaurant. Sometimes people have taken something, you know, from our cheese counter and wine shelves and brought it to somebody's dinner party. Other times somebody's, you know, sent a, you know, happy birthday gift box over to somebody else, right? But it's, I think for me, it's all part of the same effort. Operationally, it is challenging. We have a really wonderful team. And we also, I think the way that we operate was forged to a large degree during the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. We opened a year before the pandemic dropped on the world.
Okay. Yeah.
And so we were a very young business. And I think that helped us just sort of say, like, okay, we need to do to keep connecting with people, even though we can't have them in our building, we're going to do that. You know, while I'm glad to not have to jump from one thing to another, I think that period of time taught us that we're pretty resilient. And if something is interesting and worth doing, you know, we can figure it out.
Sure. I mean, there's no question that, you know, bright spot, if you can call it that, in the pandemic, I think for many was, you know, innovation and, you know, the grand pivot of, you know, trying to figure out what you can do in this, you know, unprecedented and challenging circumstance. And it sounds like you all really rose to the occasion. Is that how you started doing? I know that you do like a subscription box or like cheese clubs. It was, you know, trying to bring the joy to people rather than people coming into this multi-purpose space. Was that some of the motivation behind creating that model?
Yeah, absolutely. The wine club was something that we started fairly early on in the life of the business, but we found that people really latched on to that as we were, you know, going through the pandemic and trying to figure out ways that we could still maintain a little bit of our humanity. And then the cheese club came shortly after. You know, we had cheese laying around. Why not?
Why not?
Made sense. And then our gift boxes and e-commerce was something that I think got a real jolt from the necessity and the reality of the pandemic. So, you know, still finding, you know, conceiving of all those things in a way that kind of you can capture. We tried to think about it in terms of like not just putting a bunch of stuff in a bag or a box and handing it over, but how can we make people feel like they're still interacting with us, even if not physically, right? So like what does hospitality look like if you have to put it in a box or package it into a subscription?
So how do you do that?
For us, we try to be as playful as possible. I think that's something I think we tried to, I guess, to take a step back, try to sort of distill our approach that we take to, you know, to this day to interacting with our guests, right? So, you know, the things that we deal in, you know, great small production wine, artisan cheese, kind of like, you know, small production grocery items, you know, thoughtfully sourced food, all of that can sort of feel a little bit big, right? Or like maybe untouchable if you're not well versed in it. You know, you don't need, you know, you can feel intimidated by walking up to a cheese counter or feel like you don't know mm-hmm. how to talk to somebody about the wine that you're looking for. And for us, we try to remove a lot of that pretension and, you know, what people might imagine as barriers to interacting with that by just making it as engaging and just, I think, approaching the every interaction in a non-pretentious way, which is harder than it might sound.
How Midwestern of you.
I know, right? So I think, you know, we joke around a lot, you know, in every way, you know, amongst the team. I think, you know, levity and humor is an important part of the way that we interact with our guests as well. And then, you know, via social media and all of the stuff we do. So when we were thinking about how to sort of box up the spirit of All Together Now, that was important. Like we did a picnic kit during the pandemic, and we included mm-hmm. some, you know, just some pen and paper games on there, word searches, things like that.
Awesome.
Things that sort of like, you know, function as distractions and also ways to connect with maybe like the one person you were hanging out with then.
Right. The one person, it brings us back, but you know, you still have, you know, the clubs are still active, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. The wine and cheese clubs are super fun. We do monthly collections under a particular theme. So for example, February's theme is Better Together. So little nod to Valentine's Day,
sure.
You know, heart-shaped holiday coming up. But we try to explore that, and so we take a bigger kind of like more nebulous concept and think about how we can look at cheese or wine through that. So, you know, in the case of wine, it might be a collaboration between two winemakers who, you know, haven't worked together yet, or it's a blending of varietals. So, you know, something that's greater than the sum of its parts. And you know,
that's
when
awesome.
We think about it from the cheese side of things, it's like, you know, maybe it's a, you know, in the case of one of the cheeses we're doing, actually two of the cheeses, both are Midwestern cheeses made by really awesome goat cheese creameries. One is in Milwaukee, or just north of Milwaukee, Blakesville Creamery. We're doing a wine, essentially like a wine rubbed goat cheese. And then
Ooh.
We're using, yeah, it's so good. I mean, Veronica at Blakesville Creamery makes awesome cheeses anyway, but the addition of some, you know, Pinot Noir remnants really, really kicked it up.
That sounds fantastic.
yeah, it's so good. So this Better Together theme is going to be explored through various ways in this month's club. And so we do, you know, like a spring break themed one, Gone Wild, is the official tagline. So we have a lot of fun with it, but we also try and, you know, sneak some knowledge in there, right? So people, if they want to learn more about the things that they're, you know, they're eating and drinking, they can. And if they just want to sort of read the silly zine that they get with the book or with their goods, they can do that too.
You have a silly zine. That is fantastic.
We do, yeah.
How far in advance do you have to plan this to be able to, you know, identify your themes and then source the ingredients and then put together this zine that, you know, complements everything that you're sharing in the club?
A lot farther out than we sometimes do. So we have our year's worth of themes planned out, and we're essentially like repeating from year to year now, because there's still, even if we have the same theme January to January, it's, you know, there's still a lot of ways you can walk within that. So we know what's coming up. So I think, you know, myself and our wine club manager, we're constantly, you know, exposed to different producers, different products. And so on some level we're thinking, oh yeah, this would, you know, this would be good for the back to school theme in October, but it might be April. So we just sort of make a note of that and go on. So there is some planning, but then there's also always cool stuff popping up, especially with, you know, small producers like the ones that we work with, like, oh, like surprise. There's this like limited edition cheese. It's going to be awesome. So, we try and plan out probably 2 to 3 months in advance and then get to work on sourcing and doing write-ups and features and things like that in the little zine.
That is awesome. I mean, I'm number one, I'm hungry. Number two, I'm definitely motivated to check out these clubs. Now, how far do you ship?
We can ship wine only within the state of Illinois, but cheese can go anywhere. So Capri, I can get you a box of cheese if you're still hungry when we finish this interview.
So. Don't tempt me, because, you know, my nickname is the mouse for the amount of cheese that I consume. So I am all about it. Now we're talking cheese. We're talking wine. You mentioned one of the cheesemongers that you work with, cheesemakers. Tell me how you how you source the ingredients that you sell and that you use in your menu, and how much kind of the Midwestern terroir, for lack of a better term, an overused term, informs the kind of sourcing that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, for us, and, you know, in some ways it's sort of like a no-brainer to be sourcing locally. At this point, it just there are so many good ways to go about it. We buy directly from several farms, McClug, Nichols, two awesome produce farms, one vegetable, one more fruits and berries oriented. And then there's also just some great locally focused food distributors who can connect us with those smaller producers and those products on a more regular basis. Now our chef is a native Midwesterner as well. So, you know, she grew up in a cooking family with a strong appreciation of what was around her as well. So, and you know, both of us lived and worked in Madison, although separately. And Madison, Wisconsin has a great local food scene with a lot of emphasis.
Absolutely.
It's so fun to eat there. So I think both of us carry that with us. And then in general, when we're thinking about, you know, say a finished product on our shelves or in our cheese case, so be that a bottle of wine, a box of crackers, or, you know, a wedge of cheese. I think, you know, obviously it's got to taste good, right? But I think we see the most success. We enjoy it the most personally, and our guests, you know, come back with the most positive feedback when it's something that, producers working to, highlight quality rather than sort of churn out a commodified product, right? So I think there's an embrace of I mean, like, to use your word, that word, terroir, but the specific place where things come from, right? So we do a lot of sourcing from the Midwest on our cheeses, but even if we're sourcing, you know, from further afield, be it, you know, one of the coasts here in the U.S. or from abroad, when we find a producer that's working to highlight the environment in which an animal was raised, or the, right, you know, the land in which a grape was grown, the product is just more interesting. It's more fun to eat, and it's more fun to talk about.
I do love food with a story. No question about that. And it sounds like you put a lot of thought and care into everything that goes into your operation. And when we had a chance to speak off air, you know, I was really impressed by, you know, the fact, you know, you sometimes don't think about, you know, people do think about, well, okay, locally sourced fruit and vegetables from this farm or that farm. But, you know, when you think about, you know, salami from Wisconsin, you know, or, you know, the some of the meats and fruits and those sort of things, when you think about some of the meat products, I sometimes don't necessarily think about that. But I don't know why, but, you know, the fact that you can find those things, you know, by local producers and incorporate them into what you sell, I think is really impressive as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's, our salami producer is Underground Meats. They're in Madison, actually, a connection that both Abigail, our chef, and I made, again, separately while we were in Madison. Those guys are awesome. They are working with all local heritage breed animals using really thoughtful traditional curing processes.
Fantastic.
So they make really tasty salamis. And that is, you know, we sell those on our cheese counter, and they're an ingredient in our best-selling sandwich, which is the French exit.
And what is that?
Oh, I like to think of it as like a little handheld picnic. So we have a great baguette made from a local bread that we buy from a local bakery a couple blocks away from us called Aya. We do some house-made aioli and mustard on that. And then there's a few hefty slices of Underground Meats soprasada, so an Italian style cured salami. And then we use Pleasant Ridge Reserve, which is a fantastic Wisconsin made alpine style cheese from
that's Uplands, right?
Yes.
I know those guys. Yeah. Uplands cheese. They're fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the entire, you not only do you have a picnic in a sandwich, you have like half the Midwest in that sandwich too, which is just,
truly,
which is just incredible. Now, how seasonal is your menu? You know, you have things that, you know, you can come and get like at your cheese counter, but you also, you know, have a menu of, you know, things in your restaurant, which I'm sure you can take out, but I know that a lot of thought goes into the items that you put on the menu as well, I'm sure in collaboration with or driven by your chef. So how does that process go as far as identifying the actual menu items that you serve?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are some mainstays. We do a fried goat cheese curd, for example, from our friends at Blakesville Creamery, and that's on the menu year round. But I think, you know, cheese curds are one of those things, especially in the Midwest. They know no season. You can eat them when it's hot. You can eat them when it's cold. But I think, especially, you know, our options open up in the spring and summer, which is always so fun. I feel a little bit silly, but I'm now one of those people who's like, oh, it's ramp season.
Hey, Ramp season is amazing. I'm in Ohio, but West Virginia is down the road and they know and love their ramps. So I'm all about ramp season.
Ramps are tasty, right? But I think more than like the actual vegetable itself, it heralds the fact that, you know, it might stop being winter sometime soon.
Folks that are not familiar with ramps, they are a garlic onion hybrid that you forge. You don't necessarily go out and like get ramps at the grocery store. Like a lot of, there's a massive foraging tradition with ramps, at least in my region.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of that going on here too. And some of our more focused specialty distributors will actually, they will purchase from foragers actually, and then get them to us. So when it warms up, things start widening up. So we get a greater array of produce. I mean, in general, I think right now we're focused on cozy foods, things that, you know, make sense with the way that people are spending their time, during the winter time, just sort of hunkering down. Once winter clears out, spring and summer come in, dishes get just a little bit lighter, a little bit more produce driven. And that is made easier by the fact that all of the local rooftop farms that we work with, they spring into action with all of their tasty stuff, all the things from the fruits and vegetable farms a little further afield, into more rural parts of Illinois and, you know, into Wisconsin, and Michigan as well. What they have available just widens as well.
Absolutely. Sure. So it sounds like it's a pretty seasonally driven menu. Give us some examples of some things we might be able to find this time of year. And since, you know, this will live, you know, evergreen on the podcast, what could we expect kind of throughout the season if we were to come to visit you in Chicago?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, I think the big plates on our dinner menu are focused on, you know, we've got some legumes, we've got a black lentil cassoulet on the menu, which is awesome. So a lot of like sort of layering of flavors, a charred onion broth, a little bit of rutabaga on there. So leaning into the Midwestern larder when the temperatures are cold. We've got a red wine braised lamb shank, with an Italian style salsa verde, local carrots on that one. But, you know, as we flip into spring and summer, I'm going to have to rack my brain to remember like what kind of things we've served. So a seasonal sandwich we've done for a few summers running has been an osororati, and so it's a French sheep's milk cheese with fresh peaches. And that is just a really fun way to, you know, and eating your peaches in a kind of a savory context as a sandwich is super fun. We also do, the goat cheese producer that we work with, Blakesville Creamery, I keep talking about them because they're awesome, and she's also a pal.
I got to get her on the show. I am convinced we got to talk.
Yes. We do a Sunny Ridge, which is a beer washed goat cheese with a carrot slaw. So again, like a little bit lighter fare, but still nodding to the fact that we've got some really good cheese at our disposal there.
I'm looking at the menu that is currently online. I don't know how accurate it is right now, but I see and who knows if I'm going to pronounce this correct, a Caltango hand pie.
You got pretty close. Calcagno. So at least one of our sandwiches is always a vegetarian riff, plays with an artisan cheese in some way. So that Calcagno hand pie is, it is indeed on the menu. So if you want to, start driving after we get offline, you can.
It's a straight shot on I-80 from where I'm at. So
perfect.
got a full tank of gas.
Yeah. So that is our winter fancy cheese and
veggie. It looks fantastic. Yeah. Raw sheep's milk cheese, spinach, artichoke, pimento, and brioche. I mean, it sounds so hearty. I mean, I can tell that you all don't shy away from rich flavors, whether it is the sobrasada, whether it is the cheeses. It seems if you all are very much not afraid to, go big with your flavors.
Yeah. If you're going to eat, have fun.
I totally agree. So, what's in the future for this already pretty diverse business and space there in the Ukrainian village of Chicago?
Yes, we are in the Ukrainian village. That's the million-dollar question. What's next? I think for me, it's not a question of whether there's something next. It's more of a what and a when. As we've talked about, we kind of smoosh a lot of things, a lot of different activities into one business.
But you make it work. I mean, the thing is, you make it, from my perspective, and I definitely would love, when I'm in Chicago next, check you guys out, because from my perspective, you all have managed to thread this very, complicated needle under one umbrella and make it work, because it does have that shared spirit. So keep at it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. we toss around ideas all the time, right? So it's, our chef is she's amazing in the kitchen, has so many good ideas, so maybe it's more of a traditional restaurant. That's something that is constantly up for discussion. Maybe it's something that we all sort of in various ways amongst the team have some ties to Michigan as well. So, we love, tons of Chicagoans go to Southwest Michigan on summer weekends. So maybe, an outpost there is sort of a pipe dream, but one that is near and dear to my heart, just as my own personal connections to the state. Another location in Chicago would be amazing, whether it's, more of a wine shop and a cheese shop, or maybe our chef loves the idea of doing a butcher counter. Whatever you see from us next will be related, but I can't tell you what it's going to be.
You got time, you have the passion, you guys have the talent and the team, it sounds like, to be able to pull off whatever, creative muse, drives you next. For folks that want to find you, maybe want to join one of your clubs, if they're not there in the Chicago area, get some cheese shipped out, or want to check you out, how can they find you and learn more and maybe sign up?
Oh, wonderful. Great question. So you can find us online. We are at altogethernow.fun. That is .fun at the end. You can find us on Instagram, and you could just give us a ring too. We love to chat.
Well, like I said, don't tempt me. I might be picking up the phone and giving you all a call and getting my cheese and getting on the road and trying some of your fantastic food there. This has just been wonderful. And not only am I hungry, but I'm also inspired by how you've connected all of these different Midwestern flavors under one roof. Erin, thank you very much for taking the time to chat with us here on Eat Your Heartland Out.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Capri.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Warner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. You can learn more about the show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/Eat Your Heartland Out. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.